All right, Christopher here. Welcome to Do Explain. Before we begin, I'd like to thank my current supporters who inspire me to carry on with this project and make it financially viable as well. I'm very grateful to all of you. Big hugs. And while I'm not in the business of telling people what to do, I can share my vision for Do Explain going forward. I like to work on the podcast full-time instead of just a few days a month. I want to build a real platform for the fun and friendly exchange of interesting ideas, and I want to do it ad-free, if possible, because I don't want any ideas to be off-limits for us to explore, and I also want to keep saying dumb shit without repercussions. But to do this, I'll need a steady income, and that's why I need your help. So if you enjoy what I'm doing here, and you want to join me in my vision and become a part of growing this project, consider going over to patreon.com/doexplain and sign up to become a monthly supporter. All right, thanks for listening. I hope you enjoy this episode. All right, so I am back for the third time with Joe motherfucking Hudson. Hey, Joe, how you doing, man?
Good. I don't think I've been introduced like that since college, so I feel good.
Oh, it's about time.
Yeah. I've been waiting.
I bet. So since college, do you have a story there? Were you a wrestler or something?
No, I think delinquent might be the best word for it. And that's not true. I will not tell this whole story, but not that I mind it. It's just a very long one. But I got kicked out of my first college while having almost a 4.0 grade point average. So I wasn't a delinquent as far as doing the work and loving learning. I just had an authority issue.
And I'm loving it. Okay.
Yeah. I cannot begin to tell you the authority issue I had. Yeah. So,
I mean, I hope you still have some remnants of that, right?
Well, the interesting thing is I got kicked out of the first college. I wrote an essay, got good grades, got into the second college, which was a great college. And near the end of that time, I did all my schoolwork in 3 years because I was paying my own way through college, but I ran out of money kind of halfway through the last year, and I went to the dean of students and I said, hey, I'm getting straight A's and I'm running out of money. Can you help out? And he said, no, you know, you had to do applications, blah, 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 at the beginning of the year. And I didn't take it lightly. Instead, I sat in front of the president's office with a sign written on cardboard that said, we'll get straight A's for an education. And about 20 minutes later, I had money given to me so I could finish college.
Wow.
So anyways, but he and I maintained this kind of friendly rivalry. And so when I graduated valedictorian of the school. And so you give a speech when you graduate top of your class. And so right. I did that. And right before I'm getting on, and it was I made a horrible speech, by the way, but right before I get on, the dean of students, you know, introduces me. And he reads, he's from my essay that I got into the school with, and he reads, Joe wrote when he came to this college, the paradox of a rebel is that they either get stomped out by authority or they become an authority and start to stomp other people out. And I don't know about you, but I would say valedictorian is authority. So here's Joe Hudson. That's how he introduced me.
Yeah, exactly. Loving it.
Yeah, so I don't have a problem with authority because it's authority anymore. Then I did. It was just like anybody with an authority. Now I very much feel that if I am rebelling against an authority, I'm just as controlled as if I'm being oppressed by an authority. So for me, it's more of the idea of an authority has just disappeared. I don't see bosses and things like that. I don't see somebody who has authority. And I think all of the things that I do as far as teaching or coaching is teaching people and pointing to people to be their own authority. So I think that's how it comes now. And I think that rebellion against authority was a natural part of that process. And when I see my kids rebelling against authority, I'm supportive because I know that that's one of the steps you have to take to get to the place of recognizing your own authority.
I mean, so that's a great way to end the podcast. Joe, thanks for coming on. No, that's, yeah. I love it. I think that it sounds similar to, you know, breaking norms just to be a norm breaker.
Right.
Just as bad as following them blindly. You want to find your own way there and realize that everyone is a person and we're all fallible.
Yeah. What's interesting to me about it is that there's the emotional component too, right? Like if you're... Mm-hmm. Say the authority figure in your life when you were growing up was passive aggressive. When somebody's passive aggressive with you, you're probably less likely to listen to them. Or if your authority figure was angry a lot, when someone gets angry at you, you're less likely to listen to them. And the freedom is, oh, you're angry at me, but I can still listen and I can still see what you have to take, see what you have to give and see what I want to take from it. And so I think it goes one step deeper just between like, you're the authority and, oh, you're acting like the way my authority figured acted in when I didn't feel respected and I rejected them. And so I noticed that people, a lot of miscommunication that happens between people is based on if they're communicating in a way that reminds them of their, of the way
oppressors
that
oppressors of the past.
Yeah. Exactly. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I guess it could also go the other way around where people, where I'm thinking of an analogy perhaps to the idea of love languages and the way you got love expressed to you when you were a kid is the way you express it to other people and want it to express to you as an adult.
Yeah.
That's actually not at all what I had thought we would talk about, okay, as usual. Well, but I would love to ask you about that without knowing it. Languages, how, because I assume that you're familiar with the idea.
Yeah, I'm familiar. Right. Yeah. I think there's a broader thing that they're speaking to, and and it's that which is wires together, fires together, you know, or that which fires together, wires together in the brain. Right. And so I think the place where I use that principle most in my work is not so much about love languages, but it's more about, so let's say somebody was criticized a lot. And so when you have a parent, you know, we're biologically linked to that parent. We want their love. We want their attention. And it doesn't really matter if you're, you know, 2 years old or if you're 50 years old. You still want your parents' love and affection. Even if you're like, my parents an asshole and I want them nowhere in my life, there is a part of you that, like, if you could snap your fingers and have a loving relationship with your parents, you would have it. And so that's how we're entrained in love. And whatever they did is what we think love is. And so we repeat that pattern of, oh, look, for me, love was criticism. So I'm married to somebody who criticizes me, or maybe there's a complete rebellion against that. You know, like now I married somebody who doesn't criticize me at all, but in either way, it's controlled by that imprint, like ducklings being imprinted into their mothers. And so I think that's where the work I do a lot sits in that place of undoing those patterns so people can actually accept the kind of love that they want in their life. And so you see this all the time. Like, for instance, if someone's jealous, on one level, they're saying, I want this person. On another level, they're completely pushing the person away, right? Like jealous behavior is gross. It's unappealing. It's unattractive. It's like when somebody's jealous, you're just like, ugh. And so there's a pushing away, and there's also like, where are you going? Where are you going? Like, come back. You have this push pull inside of them. And so helping them learn that is part of the how they learned love, that it's also their own internal fight inside of them. And then for them to take full responsibility of the fact that they're pushing away in their jealousy and that that's wanted on some level. They want to push somebody away, but they don't want to admit it's their responsibility. And changing mm-hmm. that whole thing, I think, is a large part of the work. The love language is like a nice thing to understand about people, but I just see it as the bigger way of us learning what love was and relearning it to feel it as being deep affection and supportive and attunement and, you know, and love for ourselves is the way that works. Like as you learn to love yourself, then the love that you want from other people or the kind of love you want from other people starts happening.
Yeah. I mean, let's explore that a little bit because the way I often hear love languages being used is as a, almost as an immutable fact of you as a person, like, oh, but my love language is gifts or whatever. And so, that's like the only way that I will ever feel loved because that's just the way I am.
Yeah.
Whereas it sounds like at least partly it can be, or is a direct, result of your past. And like you said, your relationship with your parents and, to a large extent driven by your trauma. And so, but then the question is, let's say we all, clear away most of our trauma. Would we still expect to see, a lot of differences, when the trauma is gone? Would there be more, convergence there? Like in terms of, what the love languages would divide up as physical touch being really important because we are biological animals, all of us. And that's,
right.
Genetically programmed. What would you say there?
Yeah. So I think that, you know, they have studies about, you know, personality aspects that don't transform. An example of this would be OCEAN, which is O stands for openness, closeness. C stands for consciousness or conscientiousness, non-conscientiousness. Mm-hmm. E is extrovert, introvert. A is agreeableness, non-agreeableness. And N is neuroses. And they say that those personality traits don't move. And recently, studies have shown that if someone takes hallucinogenics, the openness, the O part of it, actually changes over long term. In our week-long groundbreakers that we do, we have had standard deviation changes in neuroses and openness. So I think that what they're saying is that for most people, like the tools to have those kinds of shifts are not standard. Most people don't use them. And so if you're doing studies over an extended period of time, then over lots of people, then there's not a lot of techniques or possibilities where those things change. But what I notice in our in-person work is we see a lot of people who like don't particularly like to be touched. Like they're like, you know, they kind of, you can see them kind of move away from it. The hugs are short and loose. Mm. And you see them by the end of the week loving being touched and like waiting, because it's so biological in us to be touched.
Yeah.
And really what it was a fear and a that was given to them in their youth. But I would say that most people's love languages stay the same through their lifetime. And it could absolutely change if you do the work.
Yeah, right. So, I mean, essentially the reason I'm grilling you on it is because my love language is definitely physical touch.
Yeah.
My wife's love language is primarily gift giving, which I couldn't care less about.
Right.
So I guess I'm a cheapskate and I'm trying to argue my way out of buying gifts for her. No, but it's so inconvenient. And that's where the framework actually has a lot of wisdom, I think, because I can think that I've been showing her love all day because I'm giving her what I would have wanted. And yet she feels completely deprived because I haven't actually taken into account what she needs. And so in that sense, I think it's very valuable.
Yeah, you're speaking actually about two things that are for me, there's other parts of this that are, I think that there is biological aspects to it. And then I also, you know, if you're hunting and gather, if your kind of genetics are for hunting and gathering, then like gift giving can be an incredibly important thing, especially if, you know, you're one of those predisposed for gathering as compared to, right? Because there's this, there's an interesting biological component. Just as like you see some people are really interested in plants and some people are really interested in animals. And I could just see how a community would need both. And so our genetics provides both. But the other thing that's, I think, far more important is just because something can change doesn't mean that you want to ever try to change anybody. And so if it comes to like your wife, then the trick is attunement. It isn't, you know, to try to change them. And I think, which is what you're pointing to, it's like, right, to understand them and to attune to them. And most pain in relationships that I see comes from two things. One is trying to change each other. And two is trying to make the other person happy. And those two things are like the cause of so much pain in relationships. And instead of taking responsibility for your own happiness, and attunement,
I mean that the first one I think many people would be on board with. The second one I think people would balk at if they haven't actually really thought about this stuff and maybe followed your stuff. And but I do think that's super important, and I think. In my own case, in my own marriage, we've been married now for 8 years. And in the beginning there, I would say that most of the suffering would boil down to, especially me feeling responsible for her happiness and her emotional state in general. I have anecdotal evidence to back that claim up as well.
I can explain it for people who bulk, and I appreciate the bulking. The first one is if you are trying to make somebody happy, if you're trying to take care of somebody, you're sending them the message that they can't take care of themselves. So you're making them small. They're going to get resentful, and you're going to get resentful because they're not going to actually, you're not going to be able to make them happy. So you're going to be like, I've done all this stuff and she still isn't happy. It's like, so that's why. Now, it doesn't mean you don't care for somebody. It doesn't mean you're not attuned. It doesn't mean you don't love them. But you allow them to have their emotions and you don't try to change their emotional state. In fact, it's far better to learn how to be with their emotions, because that the emotion that they're in that you can't be with is the emotion you can't be within yourself. And so it's a part of yourself you can't love. So the far more productive path is to be with them in whatever emotional state that they are and learn to love it in them and in yourself. And in that you feel accepted in yourself, they feel accepted. And that's what actually drives long-term happiness, not doing the dishes or making sure that, you know, that they get the car that they want or whatever the hell thing that you do to try to make sure they don't get mad at you. To try to stay out of trouble. Yeah.
Hey Joe, so I was reminded now of when you said that you had a phase. I think last time you were on here, you said that you had a phase when you were just walking down the street, feeling tremendous love for everyone, and you just wanted to say it all the time. I think I might be in that stage right now. I said a lot of stuff like that to my colleagues yesterday, and now hearing you talk, I just got struck by. Tremendous love for you and the fact that we get to talk. You're amazing, man.
I love you, dude. Thank you, man.
So
you can't see my face, but for anybody out there who's listening, I am like ear to ear grinning and I'm very touched. Thank you. Yeah.
Oh, I love that, man. And I want to say to anyone listening then that we were struggling for a bit before we started recording with technology. And I had to look at Joe's annoyingly handsome face and new haircut. And handsome son of a bitch. What did you say? 51?
51.
God, man.
Yeah.
You're never going to get to meet my wife in person. Never in a million years. Oh, man. Okay, so in the same vein there, I had a thing on my little list here where I've heard you say, and I think it's related, don't try to be useful to people.
Yeah. Yeah.
Do explain.
Yeah, so I mean, there's a couple ways to look at that, but most likely, I don't know the context in which I said it, but the context in which I said it was something to the effect of, if you are loved for what you do, you're not loved for who you are. Or if you think you have to be a certain way or do something to get love, then there's a part of you that knows that you're not loved for who you are. And so it'll just be a perpetual hungry ghost of chasing it. So as far as being like, don't be useful for to people, I think it's more, it's obviously we're all useful to each other, right? There's a way in which here I am having a conversation with you and hopefully it's useful to you. Yeah. And at the same time, I am not coming at our conversation with that intention.
Yeah.
I'm not also trying to be useful for anybody who's listening to this. What I'm doing is being authentic and being true to myself, because that then I can love myself and also the people who do show up and say, hey, I want to be around you, or people who want to be around me, not around, you know, somebody else. And our mind then says, oh, wait a second, hold on. If I do that, I won't be loved. If I do that, I won't be loved. Right. And for those people, I say, like, you can be like a sociopathic killer and you can find a community in ISIS. Right. So you can find a community that will love you for whatever you are. Right. So might as well be yourself and then find the community that can support who you are. Than to think I have to be a certain way to, I mean, it's nonsensical if you think about it. Like, oh, I have to be a certain way to be loved in today's society, makes no sense. It because you can find any community who accepts any kinds of behaviors. So be who you are. And what I notice is that in my life, anyways, the more authentic I become, the more two things happen, the more people want to be around me in greater numbers, but more importantly, it's the more it doesn't matter. If I'm really authentic, right. I'm very happy to be by myself, and I'm very happy to just be with my family, and I'm very happy to be with whatever shows up.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I think that's what I was pointing to, you know.
Yeah. I think you might have, it can also tie into the idea of inherent goodness. Like, you don't. Yeah, just you can just sink into what you are, and you will be a nice person in the end. But
it hurts us to be, and you know, like there's an idea that we have to teach people morality, and my experience is as people's trauma gets relieved, then morality is a natural thing. It's not something that needs to be taught. You just need to not, you know, beat it out of somebody.
There seems to be, or at least for me, I think I have a question mark around this, where the idea of unconditional and conditional love.
Yeah,
I heard someone talk about it like, yeah, unconditional love is something that, let's say, that's part of your inherent goodness, as it were. That's something you will naturally feel towards other sentient beings, and something that you should feel towards everyone. Like, nobody has ultimately chosen who they are and what they think and what they've done. And yeah, if you walk a mile in anyone's shoes, you'll see that you would be them in their situation, right? And that gives way to compassion to everybody. But at the same time, there seems to be a risk of falling into refusing to make any discernment whatsoever. and kind of like the fact that I want to like my friends and my wife more than anyone. If I meet someone who's really rude to me on the street, fundamentally I can realize that that person is worthy of love, but I also don't want to hang out with the person because he was being a dick to me. And so I can have conditional love where I surround myself with people who share my values and who treat me the way I want to be treated. So how do you square those two?
Great question. So the one thing I heard in your question was like, you can have emotional, and you should, what you said, and you should have this love for people. So the first thing I would say is like, that is the opposite way of getting to love. So I would never tell myself I should love somebody. So that's the first one, because for me, loving people is my freedom. It's not an obligation or a chore or a should or I'm good because I do it, or I'm a better human being because I do it. I do it because it creates freedom. And my kids have this really wonderful thing that they say about me, which they say, "Dad, you love everybody, but you don't like many people."
And yes. And that's yes.
That's very true about me. So for me, there's the unconditional love doesn't mean I'm going to act in a certain way. It means that my internal state is, oh, I have love for you. If somebody says you're a fucking dick and you asshole, and then like starts to try to punch me, let's just like go all the way with it. My freedom is dependent on whether I can love them in that state. That's where my freedom is. Now, my freedom is not dependent on whether I take the punches, and my freedom is not dependent on whether I decide to live with them or become their neighbor or work with them as a boss. And in fact, my freedom might be leaving them, or might be telling them, hey, the way you're acting right now is going to make sure that like not only I, but nobody, like all of those can be loving actions. So the love is a perspective, and it's an emotional state towards the person. The actions are all acts of that, but they might be self-care. They might be, saying the hard thing to the person. They may be letting the person suffer their natural consequences. There's a lot of ways in which that moves. And so part of what I hear in your question is there's a thought process of what loving behavior looks like. And I would question the thought process of what loving behavior looks like, because loving behavior can look, it's a Bhagavad Gita. And at the very beginning of one of the Hindu religious texts, and I'm bad with names, but Bhagavad Gita, like there's a guy, he's like praying to God, one of the gods, and is like, I don't want to fight in this war. And my brother's on the other side. And he's like, you got to fight in this war. And that whole metaphor of like, we are in life, and in life, there is inherent tension. Without tension, there is death, right? Like if I took all the tension out of a cell, that cell would die. If I took all the tension out of me, I would die. If I took all the tension out of an ecosystem, the ecosystem would die. Life's nature is tension. And so if you're going to be alive, you are going to be in tension. And so the question is, how do you bring love to that tension? It's not how do you get out of tension.
So I can love you, I don't have to like you.
Yes.
That is a really nice distinction.
Yeah. I can love you. I can love you and not want to be anywhere near you. And I can love you and draw a really clear, crisp boundary. And I can love you and say, if you come into my house with a machine gun, I'm going to shoot you.
Yeah.
Right. And it might be that love directs you a different way and says, I'm willing to be shot. But to pre-assume what the action of love is to be not be in love. It's to be in your head. It's to be in an intellectual framework. It's not to be in love itself.
So when you say that the love is the freedom for you there, is that because you are fully embracing and therefore not creating unnecessary tension by trying to be, you know, have people be other than they are? Or can you unpack that particular phrase a little bit?
Yeah, there's a couple pieces in it. The first one is it just feels good.
Hate people sucks.
Yeah, it sucks. Like all that constriction and like fighting against reality and that whole thing, it's painful. So that's part of it. But the other part of freedom is choice. So I'm working with a client and we just did a week-long program that we are trialing out and it went great. And so I was with all these folks that I coach and we were working on limiting beliefs. So we did this whole thing on limiting beliefs, whole week, really intense, 9 a.m. to 10 p.m. every day. And he came out and like, he was in a kind of, he has an ex-wife who's abusive and the ex-wife said, hey, can we talk? And he felt all the charge that he would normally feel when his ex-wife does this. Hmm. And he wrote back, what would you like to talk about? And he was describing it to me and he was saying, hey, like that was such a little thing. It was such a little thing that I did. I could have been doing that the whole time. How on earth is it that I couldn't see it? How on earth has it been 3 years that when she does that, I freak out and then I call her and then we get into a fight instead of
right,
like this thing. And I was describing to him like that, that's what I mean by freedom, is that when you can stop and feel what's going on inside of your system and create spaciousness around it and make it so that it's not yours, it's not personal, right? So the person getting angry at me isn't about me. And not that I might be doing something, you know, not smart, or I might be doing something that's mean and be unaware of it, but that doesn't mean their anger has anything to do with me. They might, you know, the pointing behind the anger might have something to do with me. Mm-hmm. But when I see that all that has nothing to do with me and I have that spaciousness, all of a sudden I have all this freedom in how to act. I don't have the obligation of loving behaviors X, Y, and Z. And so I have to be X, Y, and Z. Instead, yeah. I am with myself and I have the capacity to see things differently and move in different ways. And the more that we are in the trauma, the more we are in the conditioning, the less we are in love, the less choice we have. So there's an actual freedom to it as well. It's called that for a reason.
Something that comes up when you talk about that is when you speak about empathy, I think the way you define it is being with the person without losing yourself. Something like that. And I just want to give some background story of like oftentimes I've listened to your lovely podcast, The Art of Accomplishment. Everyone should go listen to that if they resonate with this stuff we're talking about here. But I've listened to basically all the episodes you guys have put out. And through different phases of my own journey here, I've noticed that I've listened to something and then been like, okay, so how do I do it in this particular situation? And then I want to ask you that. But then before I get to do that, I make some progress on my own. And 3 months later, I just naturally act out the solution in that situation because I've reached a higher level of emotional fluidity or the spaciousness that you're talking about, which I find really interesting. But so one thing around the empathy part that I'm still struggling a little bit with is I've tried to, I don't want to say make a rule for myself because it sounds so authoritarian, but I've tried to have as a heuristic that I almost never try to engage with any story, whether it's my own or someone else's, when emotions are flying really high. And so I've really put in an effort to be with a person and try to acknowledge their emotional state without engaging with the story at all. And thank you. It has been working to some extent, but also sometimes I feel like I'm actually missing something when I'm like, there seems to be situations where someone just really needs you to affirm the shittiness of their situation right now. Like something like, I'm thinking, okay, I hope my wife's boss doesn't listen to this, but she's been complaining about her boss a lot. And sometimes it seems like what she really needs is for me to say, oh, that sounds really shitty to have to go through that every day or something like that. Or in my own case, with all my chronic illness and my pains and stuff, sometimes I just want my wife to say, oh, I can't imagine what you're going through, feeling so much pain all the time. That sucks.
Yeah.
And that's what I want to hear. So, how do you think about it? Are there times where buying into the story can actually be a good thing? Or, how would you think about that?
Yeah, so many ways. So the first thing I would say is that the use of your heuristic is, I think, and the rules that you said you felt like they were like maybe too rigid. I love that use because you're doing an experiment. And if you're going to be your own authority, which I highly recommend, then don't listen to what I or you are saying. If you're listening to the podcast, like listen to it and create some experiments and then go out and live them and see what you learn. That's a far better way to do it. And so I love that that's how you're approaching it. It's like just wonderful. And to see them as temporary experiments, I think is just an amazing approach. So that there's
right.
As far as the empathy thing goes, there's, when my kids were young and I was parenting them and they're 3 and 4 or 5 years old and we would have tea parties with the stuffed animals and everything, I knew that that the stuffed animals weren't princesses and princesses or whatever it was. But I was fully engaged in it. Like I was there with them being in that world. And that's how I see stories because we operate in stories. We think about stories. It's what makes us humans. I think there's a book called Sapiens about this, right? And it's like we operate, we understand life through stories. And so it's just as when I'm doing the tea parties, I know this isn't real. I know that I'm not in a fairy kingdom. I know I'm in my kid's bedroom. And at the same time, I'm engaging with it. And so for me, the way that you don't engage with the story is internally. Like you don't buy into.
I don't lose myself in it.
Yeah, exactly. You don't lose yourself.
Right.
Yeah. But it doesn't mean that you don't use it as the metaphor, as the model, right? It's literally like the map. The story is kind of the map. It's not the actual terrain. And so to not use the map doesn't make a ton of sense. But the other thing that you're speaking to is just that I am so sorry this is hard for you. I never meant to hurt you. Yeah. Oh my gosh, I said that and I hurt you. That is not in any way how I want you to feel. I don't want you to feel hurt. And I'm so sorry that you feel hurt. And I say that stuff all the time because it's true. It's what it's and because it's acknowledging them and letting them feel heard. And or somebody in a big emotional state will tell me this whole thing and I'll just repeat what they said. Oh, what I heard you say is blah, 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 blah. And so that they feel acknowledged and all
but,
of that.
But you don't actually say blah, 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 I hope.
Right.
Okay. Yeah.
Right.
I could have gone bad later.
I say, oh, I really hear that you're your boss has been, you know, in a bad mood recently, and he's been treating you, and you feel like he's treating you with disrespect, and that whole thing. I will do that. I will just repeat. I will mirror, and so that they feel heard, and so that I know that I'm hearing them correctly. And I will ask questions. I'll do how, what questions, and that we teach in the connection course. And I'll do all sorts of, I'll engage with them on that story level, but there's nothing in me that believe there, like in the case of your wife, there'd be nothing in me that believed her boss is bad. And there would be nothing in me that would believe that she is a victim. And there's nothing in me that would believe that she can't change the situation. And there's nothing in me that would believe that the boss isn't scared and hurt and doesn't know exactly how to solve that problem inside themselves.
Yeah. Like, yeah.
None of that stuff would be true, but I would fully engage with the story. Yeah. And how lovely it is to do a great experiment. And absolutely, I will do this too, which is I will just not engage in the story at all. And I'll just hold somebody.
You know,
I'll just hold my daughter. Like, I don't think the end of the world is coming because the 13-year-old boy, like, told your friends that you were needy or whatever the hell happened, right? Like, no, I'm not going to agree with any of that, but I can see you need to be held. So come here.
Yeah.
Yeah.
No, I love that. I love that. And it seems kind of similar to me to when people in meditation circles mistake the idea that you don't want to get lost in your thoughts in the same way as we're talking about here. You don't want to be thinking without knowing that you're thinking, as Sam Harris calls it. But that doesn't mean you want to fully extinguish thinking. Thinking is wonderful. It's the relationship to the thoughts that is the important part.
I would also say, like, go ahead and try to extinguish thinking. Run at that
wall. No, for sure.
Run at that wall for like 2 years, and it's not a bad way. I mean, it's a horrible way to get there, but it does get you there. Really try to stop thinking for all the time, and eventually, you know, the whole thing will implode on itself.
Yeah.
But yes, I agree that you're never going to get rid of it.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. The story is, you know, it's just seen through the facade of it. It's knowing that you're watching a movie, but still being able to enjoy and get into the movie.
Yeah. I mean, I heard you say something like, there comes a time in your spiritual journey when you can see that every thought is true and false at the same time or something like that. And that's when it gets interesting.
Yeah.
That's right. I understand that now more than at a conceptual level. It's a very profound statement. Yeah.
Yeah. It's so lovely. That place is so lovely. And what I notice is that when they get there in their journey, it doesn't sound like it's happening for you, but when they get there, they feel very unstable. They're like, wait, well then how do I make decisions? And if that's happening to you, if you're there and that's happening to you, my advice is stop using thoughts to make your decisions. If you're integrated using your thoughts and the rest of yourself to make decisions, then it's not disorienting at all. It's only disorienting when you're navigation system, which was limited, you're still relying on.
I've yet to find one situation where I get stuck in looping around, not being able to get out of a certain pattern of thinking, where the question, what am I trying not to feel right now, hasn't led me out of it, basically. I found that very useful.
That's so awesome. So we could I don't know where you want to take us, but I could geek out on something I just discovered recently in this limiting beliefs thing is that we have there's kind of an emotional cycle that happens in people, and so you have whatever, let's say let's use the boss wife example. Maybe
she's gonna murder me for this, by the way. But yes, let's
maybe she maybe she, and this obviously I don't know your wife, so but maybe at first she feels angry or she feels frustrated, and then she feels despondent, and then she feels like scared, and then she feels over time, and then she would feel like, oh no, I'm going to really do something about this and I'm going to change it. And then she feels angry, and then she feels despondent. And there's this cycle that happens. And when you start looking at limiting beliefs, and you're like, oh, here's the limiting belief that I have. And then you really look at the emotional pattern of that limiting belief. So the limiting belief, there could be 100 of them here, but let's, as an example, one of the limiting beliefs is that my boss doesn't respect me. And and then you find that cycle. What happens with that emotional cycle is you live in that thought for an extended period of time. What you'll notice is that same cycle happens with a lot of limiting beliefs. It could be around exercise. Mm-hmm. It could be around your dad. It could be around your boss. And seeing that emotional cycle was something that you were taught, and creating spaciousness around it and seeing that it's actually not yours can drop multiple limiting beliefs at the same time. There's a couple hard to explain esoteric exercises we did with this group that helped them, detach from those emotional cycles. First see that, oh my gosh, this emotional pattern is happening in 20 areas of my life and all these limiting beliefs hinge on it. And then as they separate from that emotional pattern, the limiting beliefs just drop away. It's really, really cool work. Yeah. It's a little more complicated version of what you're saying.
Yeah. No, I resonate with that. I'd like to ask you a personal question.
Sure. Yeah.
You strike me as, somebody who really embodies what you teach in a nice way. And so that makes me very curious about your phenomenology. And I've asked you before about non-duality.
Yeah.
But so I'm curious, do you suffer? However you want to define that term, but would you say that you suffer in your everyday life at this stage?
Yes, when you say, I think it's important to say what suffering means. There is, in Buddhist terms, which is what I would use this, there's pain, which life is inherently painful. It's not unlike what I said earlier, life has inherent tension in it. Mm-hmm. And then there's suffering, which is pretty much I would define it in shorthand as the resistance to pain.
Yeah.
So do I still resist pain is what I'm hearing you ask me. And I have an odd answer for you. My answer is that there was a time in my life when I didn't suffer. And then now in my life, I choose to suffer. And that's kind of a weird statement. And there's a way in which it is suffering and there's a way in which it isn't suffering. This is I've never really thought about this in the last 5 years. So putting words to it is going to be a challenge.
Yeah.
I would say it's, there are moments when I have constriction. The easiest way to say it is that on a nervous system level, there are moments where I have constriction, and that constriction it's close to suffering. It doesn't feel like the way suffering used to feel by any stretch. There's also something else that happens is that you become more and more sensitive to suffering. So as an example, Tara and I were putting on this retreat and I just came back from the month off and it was a lot to do in a short period of time. And Tara and I, as the day before the retreat, we're sitting there with the two people who are assisting us, and Tara and I got in a fight. And at the end of the fight, we, you know, looked at the folks and I don't know, the fight was maybe like 5-10 minutes. Hard to tell what time was. And we looked at the people who were assisting us, who knew us well. And we're like, we're so sorry that, you know, if that created any tension in your system for the fight that we just had. And they were like, that was a fight. And
okay. All right.
And then we're like, yeah, that's probably one of the worst fights that we get into. And they both like held their heart and they went, oh, like it was like it touched them. And so there's this weird thing in that, like, were we suffering in that moment? Is an interesting question to be asking. And I can't say that we weren't. So I would say, yeah, we were suffering in that moment. And I would say that there was constriction and we were, you know, fighting against a reality on some level and struggling. Mm-hmm. And for me, that is a really important part of the creative process. And so I very much chose to, like, there was a place where I could go where that wasn't the case, where it was like, oh, whew, everything is big, open, spacious awareness. And
yeah,
and
yeah.
And then there was a choice, a very definite choice of, nope, I am part of the creation. I want to create. I want to love. I want to feel all the emotions, including constriction, including resistance. And I want to fully be in that. And so, and then the other thing is, and there's a part of me that all knows it's fake. That all knows it's just a sham. That all knows it's like a story that I don't believe. And it does play out through me. So I don't know if that answered your question, but it's the best I can do.
No, that's okay. So let me digest that for a few seconds.
Okay. Yeah.
I mean, my first comment would be, I had a guest maybe 3 episodes back called, Ayla. I don't know if that's all she calls herself. She's like a famous Twitter person, I guess.
Okay.
And she said almost exactly what you seem to be saying here, which was that she did 10 months of acid, big doses of acid, once a week, which is an unusual thing to do. And she reached this, according to her, extremely pleasant, free from suffering type of blissing out on emptiness or, you know, spacious awareness, like you said there.
Yeah.
And where she then made a very conscious choice to come back into the world, as it were. And she said the same thing. She had to relearn how to be anxious and how to be experience some of this tension. And she wanted to choose that, but it was a choice at this stage, which was important to her. Oh, and sounded similar to what you said, which is why I thought that was extra interesting. But do you think, because I guess one of the reasons I'm asking is because I'm much like yourself, very interested in certain Buddhist practices and claims there about ending suffering, if you go all the way, I suppose.
Yeah.
And the traditional idea of this type of grasping at experience, trying to get a hold of it and keep it for yourself, where that's something that's impossible to do because experience is ephemeral and it's empty and it's impermanent and all these things. And so you're basically fighting reality when you're trying to do that. And so seeing through that phenomenological grasping is, in a sense, liberative. And if you take that to be what suffering is, do I read you correctly that in that spacious open awareness state that you said that you could find even in the fight there, that would somehow take away from or have some element of dissociation, or it's not possible to hold the tension and the friction in the spaciousness in a way where you wouldn't suffer?
There's so many
Yeah. That, yeah, right.
Yeah, you are holding it inside of that space for sure. So that right, that right. is happening. My question would be, what are you really wanting to know? What's the thing, not about me, but like, what is it that you're really wanting to?
Yeah. That's a great question. It has to do with my struggle with, or my continual challenge, we could call it, with chronic illness. And so suffering has been a big part of my life since I was maybe 19, so a little over a decade now.
Yeah.
And it's been more defining of my life than I would have wanted it to be if I could choose. And so I guess I've noticed that there is a difference between pain and mere discomfort,
yeah.
and suffering, as in what you said, the aversion to the pain, trying to push it away. Yeah. But I'm also interested in someone like Sam Harris. He would say that there are four states a person can be in. You can be in happy mind, happy body, happy mind, unhappy body, and then the mirror image of that. So four different states. Yeah. And in a very real sense, you can separate them, although not fully, of course, but there is a space that no matter what your experience is like and your body is like, there is freedom to be gleaned in every moment. And so I guess that's the context that I'm coming from, not knowing quite how to live meaningfully and joyfully in a world that's always colored by a lot of pain and uncomfort.
Yeah. So what I'm hearing you say is there a place where I don't have to be in this situation? That's what I'm hearing. Can you tell me, is there a place that I can get to where I don't have to be in this situation? And that question puts you in the situation that you don't want to be in.
Yeah. No.
And so my question to you is, what would it take for you to love not just the pain and the experience of that, but the resistance to it? Those moments where you're like, just fucking, could this thing fucking end? Please fucking end. How do you love yourself in that state? And so, yeah, you could do the meditative thing, which I think is great, where you see that you're the awareness, not the pain itself, and that you can be in that. I'm sure you've hit that at times and mm-hmm. know the relief in that. And yeah. I would also suggest finding the place where you can love yourself in the anguish, where you can be in the anguish and be that which is holding you and loving you and telling you that, you know, and so loving the anguish itself and loving yourself in it. That mm-hmm. that would be, I would say, a more productive set of experiments than trying to understand if there's some place that you can be relieved.
Right.
Because the trying to be relieved is the thing that is preventing it.
Yeah. Yeah. No, that's the lovely bind there. It's like you say there, I have experienced I have been surprised by how much physical discomfort one can be in and still feel okay with it, yeah. or even embrace it, as you say. And I got a little emotional when you started talking about it there, and I want to be mindful yeah. about not throwing emotion at you without your permission. So
that's okay. Yeah.
So the principle of embracing intensity would apply just as well to physical discomfort, like pain and nausea and things like that.
Yeah. During our last masterclass, there was a guy who basically was like, what the hell just happened? I embraced intensity and my perception of my pain, which was the exact same pain that I was in, just completely shifted. And now I feel like I'm in a lot less pain. So yes, and there's stories of people, you know, who, you know, there's a story, I think it like guy was in Hawaii and, you know, he was had polio way back and a lot of pain and went you know, read, I think it was an Eckhart Tolle book, and saw his resistance. Right. Saw the resistance to the pain. The pain dropped in half. The pain was still there, dropped in half.
Yep.
He said he needed less drugs, and the doctors were all scared he was going to kill himself, because usually somebody in that much pain when they get less drugs wants to kill themselves. So yeah, there is a, yes, embracing intensity is the same that way. And what I notice is that if you're embracing intensity, it means that you're not embracing it to get rid of it. If you're embracing the intensity to get rid of it, right, then you're not actually embracing it. If you're embracing the pain to get rid of it, then you're actually not embracing it. It has to be a full welcoming.
Yeah.
It has to be. And there's this amazing freedom that, and particularly in physical pain, that can happen where you, like what, like a practice I would suggest is, when you're in that kind of pain, feel the pain for, you know, 30 seconds or something like that. And then walk right into the very center of the sensation. Literally, physically, like, oh, I am choosing to get closer to the pain. And so you put your attention to the center of it, and it feels like you're walking right into it. And then look, be in the center of it and look out from the middle of the pain. Instead of looking at the pain, be the pain, like, and look out. And then in a little while, the pain will kind of move, and then walk back into the center of the pain and keep on walking to the center of the pain and keep on looking out from the center instead of looking at it from the outside. And try that out. See what happens. It's a really cool experience, but it is a full embrace. It's like, yeah, it like, you might even find like, wait, the pain's going away. Wait, I want it to come back because I want to be able to do this some more.
Okay. Yeah. I don't know if I go that far in my prediction, but maybe you're right.
Unfortunately, I have a meeting that I'm supposed to be at, and
I can make
them wait for 5 minutes, but I'm going to have to go pretty soon.
Absolutely. So let's see. I had some Twitter questions. So let's see if I can end on one of those, perhaps.
Yeah.
Let's see here. So what limitations does Joe see in just diving deeper and deeper into traditional Buddhistic practices?
It depends on which Buddhist practices. I mean, Tibetan Buddhist is going to be very different than Zen. It's going to be very different. I think that the biggest limitation for most general Buddhist practices is that the head comes online much quicker than the heart. And that you can do the Buddhist practice and do the emotional practices simultaneously. And the whole thing moves quicker than either one on their own. So I think that's, and that, there's some Buddhists that is different than that, you know. But you'll notice that a lot of Buddhist teachers don't have a tremendous amount of joy. Some of them do. And the joy seems to come after decades. And so you can actually do both. The two works at the same time. They're not mutually exclusive. So that would be one of them. And then the other one I would say is that if you buy the story of Buddhism, it's a much slower road. If you can do the whole Buddhist practice and not take it seriously, so to speak, to hold it very lightly and to see it as a grand experiment. And that's not to say don't be grateful. Be grateful. Mm-hmm. It doesn't mean don't love your teachers, or it means just to see that it's a pointer, but it's not the destination. And to not let your personality identity get wrapped up in Buddhism. At its core is the disintegration of identity. It's not to become a Buddhist.
Yeah, no. Even though I kind of look like a Buddhist now. But no, that's great. Thank you so much for your time, Joe. Is there anything you want to promote before you leave us today?
I think we talked about it. There's one question I'd love to ask you before we jump, which is, you said you've listened to every podcast, and we have that experience with a lot of folks. We have a lot of people who started listening to the podcast and then just like listen to every single episode, and you know, the numbers are growing and growing. It's been cool. And I'm just wondering, what is it that drives that behavior in you? What may like, I'm you could say that it's interesting or something, but I'm just curious, like, what's happening for you as you, like, listen to every episode?
Good question. Yeah. So part of it, I think, is that I like you as a person. I like listening to you. Part of it is probably also coming from some kind of falsely attributing authority to you, or something where I feel like I need to know all these things. There probably is a should there as well as a want, which can be hard to disentangle sometimes. But I've actually felt lately that it's going to sound counterintuitive. I appreciate the podcast more now, but I feel less of an urge to always listen to every episode. So that's probably a good sign.
Yeah, that makes me happy.
Because I do feel I'm deep into my somatic practice. I feel like I have a high level of emotional fluidity myself now. Yeah. And so I feel more able to trust my own stuff and then have your input occasionally as like, try this, like you said. So
that's cool. That makes me really happy. It's not, I'm not sure if that answered the question as much as but it made me really happy, which is that the podcast is doing whatever it's doing. It's allowing you to see your own authority, be your own authority. And it's becoming like maybe a road sign here, there, or a question here, there that you get to experiment with. That's great. Oh man. Thank you for sharing that. That's awesome, man.
Yeah. No, thanks for asking.
I got to run.
Have a good day, man. Yeah. You're up.
Bye. Thanks, bye. Bye.